G'day, this is Tom Uren of Seriously Risky Business, and I'm here with the Gruck.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'd like to thank our founding corporate sponsors, Proofpoint, and also the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative for their support of this podcast. So, Gruck, you tweet a lot, and you were telling me about this tweet that you thought illustrated how different, I guess, actors have different motivations.
Right, right.
And different interests, even.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a tweet by a media company covering cyber stuff, and, you know, they bring up that Killnet, which is a sort of a Russian, I'm going to heavy air quotes on this, hacktivist group. It's, you know, basically run by the state. Anyway, so they've made this big announcement, you know, we're calling on everyone to come and attack the U.S., you know, a big DDoS, let's do this. And that's almost the entire tweet. They're just saying, like, Killnet has called for everyone to attack the U.S. And so I pointed out that the point of Killnet is basically to get media attention, right? Like, it's essentially a tool of information warfare used by the Russian state. Every time it gets coverage, they've achieved their goal. That's it. They don't have cyber capacity of any sort, really. So my point was, you know, like, let's stop covering them and basically defang them as a threat, as an issue. And there was a reply from a guy at Talos who says that it's very valuable for my work. I appreciate the tweets.
I thought this next bit was amazing, where he then continues to say, look, I actually agree with you, but I've seen groups go from zero to hero. And then the caveat is, not actually heroes. So we've got the different interests, right? We've got Killnet. They want to achieve something. They've got, in this case, I guess it's a proxy for the media, and, you know, they can't not report it. That's their job, really, right?
Uh-huh.
And there's other people who sort of understand that, but at the same time like it being reported, right? And your point to me was that this is like a microcosm or an example of different interests that we also see in the cybersecurity industry and governments. And so we thought we'd talk about that today.
Right. What I found interesting about this exchange was that what you have here is, you know, the interests of the Russian state is to have this hacktivist group, again, heavy air quotes, gain media attention. It's in the interests of the media to report on things that are newsworthy, such as, you know, big threats against the U.S.,
yep,
whether they're big or not.
Yep.
Right? It's in the interest of the U.S. and, I would say, sort of civil society as a whole to not have media attention on this group.
Yep.
Right? It's better off if they do not have any influence at all. And so that's what I'm pointing out. But then for other people, coverage of these groups is useful because they need to monitor them and see what's happening and sort of keep track of everything. So again, you've got a different set of interests in having awareness of this.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a tension there of all of these differing interests. And it's, I think the sort of thing that we would like to get to talk about is not just that obviously there's different interests, but it's at what, you know, at what threshold, at what point does industry and the state work together, or can the state compel industry to serve the state's interest? You know, when does it?
Yep. Yeah.
When do these interests converge?
Yeah. So here in Australia, they have the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, and they put in an effort to have these collaboration centres around the country. And the idea originally was that you'd have government bodies and industry people co-located in these collaboration centres. And I'm a big fan of collaboration and actually working together in the same space. I think you get stuff done sort of organically.
Mm-hmm.
But it never worked out. And the reason someone told me from their point of view, from an industry point of view, is that the type of person you would put in that place is just really super expensive. Like, they're a well-qualified, highly paid person doing really valuable things for the company, and to move them into a place where they're really doing, I guess you'd call it a public good in a sense, maybe. he could just never justify it. And that seems like one of those examples of where industry collaboration and government collaboration is just difficult for reasons that are way deeper than we don't have a good space. And so I guess the first question I had back to you was, well, does that mean that public-private partnerships are doomed?
I think that, you know, it shows that there's a need for more information sharing. And so what I was going to say is that the NCSC in the UK, one of the ways that they've gotten around the exact same issue is they've said, first of all, that you have to have buy-in from both sides, right? Like the managers on the industry side and the evil spooks on the government side have to both want the whole thing to succeed. And then the business case on the industry side is that you send someone away for, you know, 4 weeks or something like that, and they gain experience that they couldn't get if they just stayed at the company. So they get, you know, exposure to writing, the requirements for protocols, or, you know, helping to draft policy, or looking at the entire industry and the threats for the entire industry rather than just one company or one sector. And so, like, this experience makes them more valuable when they come back. It also, the other thing is that the people really liked doing it. Once they'd gone away and they came back, it was for them very valuable. So it helped with retention as well.
So
that was sort of a perk of the job. So it required understanding these intangible benefits that you would get by doing this in order for it to succeed. And I can see that if you don't have the right people, that's just not going to happen. You sort of, those are not obvious things that you would see from the outset. You'd sort of have to go through it a bit and then go, okay, so this is the benefits that I'm getting out of it. This is worth sticking around for.
Yep. I guess that's a case of once you've done it a bit, it's kind of how do you get that flywheel started in the first place? But anyway, let's move on to, I guess, one good example of where it looks like there's been a lot of collaboration is actually around the Ukraine war.
So this is, I think, quite interesting because just the level of involvement here from Microsoft is, as far as I know, it's unprecedented, right? So Microsoft started out sort of just offering, security support, monitoring, stuff like that. And it escalated to the point that Ukraine basically moved all of their government systems onto Azure. I mean, once they were on Azure, they were located in data centers outside of Ukraine. They were no longer vulnerable to missiles and so on. And Microsoft assisted very, very heavily with all of that to the point that they actually stopped taking on new customers in Europe because all of their capacity was devoted to Ukraine. And so they literally froze signups on Azure at that point, which, you know, like that's a huge move. And
And congratulations to Microsoft for doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And I think also to Ukraine. I mean, can you imagine your state moving to a 100% cloud-based platform in a matter of very, very few months while also in an existential fight for its life?
Well, I think that's one of the key things, right? That I guess part of the point of this discussion is to talk about thresholds.
Uh-huh.
And I think on one hand, you've got, business as normal, peacetime. And I think there's quite strong, I won't say barriers, but the
inertia, I think.
I just think that the companies do what they do and governments do what they do. Maybe inertia is the right word, but they've got their interests and they're pursuing them. And then when you get to existential war, those interests align a lot because it's existential, right? And so where are the different thresholds?
Right.
So I guess I can imagine that happening if there was an existential crisis.
Right. So I was going to say, like, so if, you know, East Timor suddenly invaded, East Timorese army sort of thundering across the outback. So I think Ukraine and Microsoft is interesting because Microsoft has sort of really stepped up. They've gone the extra mile Ukraine, you know, they've been in a position where not only were they willing to collaborate like this, but they were going to do whatever it takes to get there. But I think a counterexample is going to be Albania versus Iran.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And, you know, what you've got there, you've got a NATO member country, you've got a conflict between this country and Iran, who are nobody's friend, basically.
Yep.
And, you know, the Albania is clearly not capable of, okay, there's no good way of putting it, never mind. Albania is kicked by Iran.
right. In the cyber domain, right?
In the cybers, yeah. Albania has not been a particularly tough target in the cyber domain. They've suffered extensively from multiple huge attacks from Iran. It almost caused an international, well, it did cause an international incident when it happened. This is a big deal, right? And one sort of wonders, like, why doesn't Microsoft go to Albania and sort their stuff out? It seems to me, just, you know, on the surface level, you've got a cyber conflict, which is where Microsoft is obviously going to be able to do the most good, right? It's sort of their thing. You've got Iran, who is nobody's friend at this point, and they are doing an attack against a NATO member that has caused international incidents in the past, raised the specter of, you know, Article 5. If Microsoft is going to step in and just help a state get their shit together, Albania is a good candidate.
Yeah, and so, I mean, my first thought is that they're not doing it because there isn't the same headline-grabbing physical death and, like, literal death and destruction that occurring in Albania as compared to Ukraine. I mean, I guess another argument may be that, well, Ukraine is actually happening, and so that's where we're going to focus, which also seems fair enough.
Right. I'm certainly... I'm playing devil's advocate, except not necessarily for for the devil. I think it's reasonable to understand why Microsoft hasn't gone out of their way to help Albania do backups, right? Or, you know, figure out that, you know, patching things in a shorter life cycle than 6 months is a great idea, you know?
Right, yeah.
Or investing in a firewall, you know, or two even, if you want to go crazy, right? So there's, you know...
I guess this is, like, that's a great example of like, they're just being different thresholds, right? So at some point...
Exactly.
Microsoft, and I imagine every company would step up under the right circumstances. But it seems one of the things that occurs to me is that different countries draw the line at different places. So the Chinese state, there's much more of an expectation that companies align themselves with the state.
Yeah, but this is sort of all the time. Like, the threshold for that is basically company exists, right? It's not like existential threat.
No, that's right.
Right.
And I was wondering, I mean, my natural inclination is to think that capitalism and the way we do things is better. Air quotes. But then, you know, when it comes to this, is it better? That's a real question.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, let's not economic theory shame anyone. You know, this is a safe space. But yeah, so I'm wondering if it's really capitalism so much as culture, right? Because, you know, the companies that are getting state support are very much capitalist companies, right? I mean, Huawei is not a charity. It's not it's not run on, you know, Marxist-Leninist principles of, you know, the means of production belongs to the workers and stuff like that. It's just that the state is deeply involved. Similarly, and say things like the state is very deeply involved in agriculture in the U.S. You know, if you look at all the subsidies and ensuring that prices are set at a certain level, you know, protection, on and on, you know, no one is a laissez-faire capitalist open market thing.
Yep.
So I think it's more cultural.
One of the interesting things is that the Communist Party has this kind of ethos of struggle. And so there's always this element of fighting against the outsider. And so although I'm saying, or I've said that the thresholds are different, the kind of motivation of the reason why the threshold is different is because you're facing a threat of some sort, an outside threat.
That's an interesting point. And I think it's worth bringing up Russia here as well, because you've got a authoritarian regime running it's a personalist government. It's running a country where, literally the head guy can decide that he doesn't like one of the oligarchs and has them, bumped off. There's a lot of state involvement. You ask, could you fund this project? And it's not a request to fund a project. It's an order to go and fund this project. So there's state involvement, but it's done differently. It's not by having, a general in the PLA will also be a board member, and the CEO will be a Communist Party member and will be, the regional chair or something like that. There's sort of this more tight integration formally between the state and industry in China, whereas in Russia, that's not the case. And there's also a sense of everyone sort of involved in their own little corruption thing, stealing from the state, and that's accepted and understood. Yeah, culture plays a part. It's not just the circumstances externally.
Well, as you were talking, what I was thinking is that as the existential threat gets bigger, I think all societies would probably end up in much the same place where everyone's aligned, but because it's existential, right? And so in a way, China and Russia are better placed already to end up in an existential crisis because they've got mechanisms and cultural behaviors that put them in that space already. They kind of already have links and know how to operate, whereas our societies would have to transition into that space.
Yeah, you remind me, there's this great paper called Why Big States Lose Small Wars by Mack, is his last name. Basically, he explains why the U.S. lost Vietnam, and his framework just, it works everywhere. It's brilliant. But one of the things in it is that for the large state, any small war is not existential by definition.
Yep.
It's, an expeditionary force sent to the other side of the world to quell a rebellion or, to deal with a civil disturbance. And so internally, you've got this issue of what's called the butter or guns. Like, what are you going to spend your budget on? And if you are the big state, it's a small amount on guns and the rest of it's on butter. But the longer the war goes on, the more people wonder, why are we spending this money this way? Whereas for the small state, it's existential. Absolutely no one is saying we need to reduce the gun budget and get more butter.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's okay that we're being occupied. It's okay that there's tanks on our land. It's time to go back to paying for good things instead of, fighting this war. Like, that just doesn't happen because it's absolutely obvious why you need to do that. Whereas in the large state, that's just not the case. It's not at all obvious why you'd have to spend this money on a conflict. Right? It makes no sense. And so I think what we're sort of saying is that exact dynamic plays a huge role in terms of how close the state can get to not just partnering with the industry, but what sort of interests me is at what point can the state dictate to industry what it should do, right? So I guess if we're talking about thresholds, what would be the threshold for the U.S. to say to Google, all of the telemetry data that you have on the continent that we find interesting due to this threat, you have to give it to us.
Yeah, right.
You have to serve these exploits to this person. We know that you know about him because he has a Google account. You have all this data. You have to do this. What would be what's the level where that happens? Can that happen?
I've always thought of the United States as someone once described them to me as an enterprise-owned state. And the business of America is business. And so my immediate thought is that that threshold is when there's a greater risk to business from the enemy than there is from Google doing that thing. And mm-hmm. and I mean, it's got to be significantly bigger because it's got to get over that inertia, right? The sort of reluctance of change. I don't know what that actually looks like, though. I think that's a pretty high bar, right?
Right. So I've actually just recalled, I've been doing a research project, and one of the things that came up, going back to Ukraine, there's this very interesting set of things happening. So just one example off the top of my head is that Yandex Maps and other map app companies that are controlled by Russia have been banned in Ukraine. Like, you're not allowed to use a Russian geolocating map application. Very sensible.
Definitely seems like a good idea.
Right. See, it seems smart, right? But something like 15% of the population uses VPNs specifically so that they can use these apps.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
Like, they want to use Yandex Maps so badly that they will, you know, break the law, such as it is, just to have access to that. And that, at what point does Yandex Maps and the Russian state cooperate? And you got to think that it must be happening.
I would have thought so. And I guess one of the things I was thinking about is that one of the reasons the US doesn't do it is because it really poisons the international market for their companies. And the flip side is Chinese companies like Huawei in particular, but other ones have been tarnished by the risk that they'll be compelled by the state to do something. And so there's a peacetime advantage to having that, I guess I'd call it a firewall between the state and industry.
Right.
And when that doesn't exist, it's actually a detriment when it comes to international markets.
Right. So I was going to say, like, what this seems to me is actually, like, you've got a soft power advantage during peacetime to stay out of it, right?
Yep.
But during conflict, there's a hard power advantage to compelling them to cooperate.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Okay, and so another example out of Ukraine, which I think is really, really interesting, is gambling apps. Again, it's a slightly weird one, but there's a large number of Russian-owned companies that offer gambling to Ukrainians. And these companies are, let's just say they're dodgy as hell, right? Like, historically, the way that you got the apps was, for example, you would sign up and then you'd give over your information so that they could make a test build, right? They'd use their iOS development kit and they'd enroll your phone as one of the testers.
Right.
And then they would compile it and ship you the app. Like, it wasn't through the app store. With Android, you have to sideload.
Right.
Right. Like, they had a download on their thing and you could pull it down and then sideload it. Again, not available on the app store. And, you know, you have to look at it and you got to say, like, a gambling app is obviously pretty bad from a security point of view. And we're talking, you know, state security, right? It's you have to give over a huge amount of information. Right? They don't let you gamble as, like, Joe Schmo, the random, you know, whatever. You have to, you know, gamble, which is, if you're doing that habitually, that's really not good for security. And, you know, due to gambler's ruin, the theory that any gambling game that pays out less than 100% of the time, you will eventually run out of money.
Yep.
And you got to think, like, having lots of personal information on people who are deeply in debt to a Russian company.
Yep.
That can't be good for security, right? Like, that's got to be.
No, that's right.
And so there's sort of a question of, like, are these gambling apps just dodgy apps trying to make a buck, or are they something more? Is it actually an effort at recruiting people and getting them to do stuff? And let's just assume that it's being state run, because I think that's a more interesting example.
Uh-huh.
But you have the state sort of using industry as part of affecting states' interests during a conflict. I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
The idea that they would set up apps just to recruit people that they could then get to sort of spy for them or do, you know, whatever, like sabotage and things like that.
Yeah.
It's very, very cool.
Yeah. I think the idea is intriguing. I wonder if it's one of those things you take advantage of opportunistically rather than, I mean, to me, it seems fairly, that would be exceptionally good long-term planning. Which,
right.
Whereas
right,
yeah, I think if you became aware of it, you'd go, oh, that's interesting. Let's do something about that.
Right.
So, yeah, like part of the curious stuff about that is some of these things were founded after the war.
Right, yep.
Some of these things sort of just cropped up afterwards, which is...
Okay.
It's a bit of a smell, but on the other hand, it's they've sort of been banned and they, you know, come back, you know, now it's another name, so it's okay now. There's a lot of stuff going on. It's not clear whether it's just trying to evade the restrictions earlier or whether it's part of an active campaign.
Right, yeah.
I think one of the things to bring up is that the difficulty with using an app like that for actual espionage is one of the more crucial things is picking the right people to recruit. It's sort of the targeting that will enable you to get what you want. It's someone with access, someone with influence, someone with access to someone who has access.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're just going out and getting, you know, random people who gamble and are willing to not just sideload, for example, but, you know, if you had someone who was going to give you enough information about their device that you could enroll it as a test device in your, you know, company's build plan, like, that's probably not going to be the same person who has a top secret clearance and works at some of the highest levels of government or the military or whatever. I think you're probably getting low-level people of that. And, you know, as I said, it's the lack of targeting, I think, would be an issue. It's still a very interesting idea.
Yeah.
And I think it can show that sort of the state using industry for hard power.
Yeah.
As we were saying.
Yep. So we've talked about how different states have different thresholds. Seems like we agree that if you're actually in a war, having the ability to compel is just a thing that would happen. Eventually, like no matter what the society, but China already has that culture to a much greater degree, and that has costs in peacetime. But when the pressure's high enough or the heat's high enough, I think everyone's going to do the same thing. So it's not as if they're totally off the planet compared to everyone else. They're just at a different place already.
Right. What we've gotten to is at one end of the spectrum, you have sort of total alignment of industry and the state. We could say, like, North Korea would be the example of this, right? The industry and the state are the same thing. There's no difference.
Yep.
And at the other end, you know, they're completely diverged, doing their own thing. And somewhere along that spectrum, you know, you've got all these other states. And in to a degree, the level of alignment on interests is a function of, I guess, threat to society overall, right? So if the industry and the state are sort of both threatened by the same thing, then their interests will align, whereas, you know, obviously not in the other case. And so Ukraine would be the example of an existential threat, is a threat to everyone, you know, in Ukraine, but it's also a threat to a lot of other industries outside Ukraine. And so their interests become aligned with, you know, the state immediately. Albania is a case where the threat is one that we all share, but that sort of threshold hasn't been reached where interests suddenly align.
Yeah.
And, you know,
where people care
start
enough.
Working together.
Okay, thanks a lot, Grok.
It's a pleasure. Good talking to you.